The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
We're on the road to Zion. That is, we're born to rule, each one of us. That's why we're called. That's what it's all about. You're called to be a leader. I want us to think about that today. Called to be in the first resurrection, to be kings and priests in the world to come. Perhaps even called to be pillars at headquarters. In heaven, God has 24 elders that seem to be counselors and advisors to him. It's my speculation that we, some of us perhaps, might even be a part of his counselors and advisors. The first fruits are first. They're first because they're going to be the first ones to help in the world to come. And they'll help bring the rest into the family of God. I want to make something clear here today, and that is this, that a leader is someone who leads, they're out in front, doing what others do not. And I want to say this too, that in life and in the church of God and in our history, both past and future, there have been leaders who have had to stand in the gap, given their lives, had to speak the truth. And that's a certain kind of leadership when you're going to be cut down for it. There's different times and different forms of leadership. What I'd like to talk to you about today a little bit is the leadership that we display, I guess, to one another in the church of God and in the families and so on. Because think about this for a minute. You're a leader destined to lead, destined to rule in the kingdom of God. But if you're a husband, you're a leader, aren't you? You're leading your household. You're leading your family. If you're a wife and a mother, you're leading your children and the rest of the family. And it kind of keeps going right on down. If you're a young person today, you are a leader at your school, and you're an example to every one of them. If you're an elderly woman, why, you're advised by God in the Bible to be an advisor to the younger women, aren't you? A leader. Every one of us, wherever we may be, whatever our gender, whatever our position in the church of God, every one of us have a leadership role right there. And I think it's vital that we think about this today, and I think in one sense, even because of what we heard last week, we had a sermon basically talking about mistakes we'd made in the past. But what I'd like to do is carry that a step further, and that is, how do we not make those mistakes in the future? What are we to be like? What is leadership to be like in the church of God? James McGregor Burns, in his book Leadership, says this, "Leadership is the most observed but least understood phenomena." I think we have to agree that leadership has been misunderstood in the past within the church of God. I believe it is deeply misunderstood by leaders in our world today. President Nixon wrote a very famous book called Leaders. And in it, he wrote some fairly interesting things. Let me read this. He says this, "What are the qualities needed to be a great leader? What sets leaders apart from the rest? For the last 35 years, I've had an exceptional opportunity during an extraordinary period of history to study the world's leaders firsthand. In evaluation of a leader, the key question about his behavior traits is not whether they're attractive or unattractive," he says, "but whether they're useful. And so he says, guile, vanity, dissembling, in other circumstances, why, these might be unattractive habits, but to the leader, they can be essential." He continues, "The leader, he needs guile in order to hold together the shifting conditions of often bitterly opposed interest groups. He needs a certain measure of vanity in order to create the right kind of public impression. He sometimes has to dissemble in order to prevail on crucial issues. No one becomes a major leader without a strong will or without a strong ego. Lately, it's become fashionable," he says, "to try to conceal the ego, to pretend that it does not exist, to present instead an outward modesty. But," he says, "I've never known a major leader who was not an egotist." He never knew the great leader, Jesus Christ. I really believe that, because I don't think Christ is like any of these things. We live in a deceived world. Satan has deceived the whole world, and one of the things I think he's deceived people on the most is this issue of leadership. That is, I think many leaders, the issue is to stay on top, to have status, to have power. Their struggle is often for position. It's striving for self. We're not called to be leaders in this world. We're called to be leaders in the world to come. And we're called to be leaders even now, amongst and working with one another. And so for that reason, I think we need to understand something, a number of things. Let's go over to Luke 22. Luke 22. Eventually we'll be resurrected. We'll be in the clouds. We'll rise to meet Christ in the air. And I believe we'll there go to the very heaven of God's throne. And on a sea of glass, there'll be a table and a marriage supper. And Jesus Christ will there serve us. And he's prepared it for us and will serve us there. It's his leadership style. Luke 22. Luke 22 and verse 24. Luke 22, verse 24. It says this, speaking of the disciples, "And there was also a strife among them of which of them should be accounted the greatest. And he said unto them, The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But you shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief, as he that does serve. For whether is greater, he that sits at meat, or he that serves? Is not he that sits at meat, but I am among you as he that serves." And that's the way Christ was when he came to this earth the first time. He was a servant to mankind. Even when he was tired, exhausted sometimes, he would keep going, and he would serve those people, feeding them, teaching them, and whatever was needed, healing them in other times. He's our example to follow, and that's what I think we've got to see, and that's what we've got to become like. And so today I want to give some keys to Christian leadership. And I think key number one is so vital to have the right motive for leadership and those things that we do. Many people in this world want to be leaders. They clamor to be leaders. They undercut others to be leaders. And what's the reason? So they can be on top, so they can have status. Think about this in the religious world for a minute. You've all seen the TV evangelists in their sequin jackets. You've seen them prancing and dancing on the stage, seemingly pulling miracles out of their pocket at will. What's all that about? Really, what's it all about? Thousands of people contributing money, living in beautiful homes, driving beautiful cars, chauffeured in many cases. It's about vanity. It's about showmanship. I remember one, I had to hand it to the guy that he had choreographed his sermon right along with the orchestra. And so when he was going to make his point, whether it be a drum roll and a cymbal crash as he made his point and his hand came down on the table there. But it's amazing. But you understand what my point is. What is motivating them? Please analyze our motives for the service that we do for the Church of God. Are we here serving others? Or are we serving God? Or is there an element of perhaps serving ourselves? I think in many cases there is a mixture. At least I know in my case there was always a mixture, that I started out with an attitude of wanting to serve God and wanting to serve His people, but within there was a desire for some recognition. I know it now looking in retrospect. If you would ask me when I first started out, I probably would have denied that. I talked to an elder who has been faithful over many, many years, and I asked him once, because he was working with us in Spokesman's Club, and he would go down to San Diego, work on jobs, he'd correct the papers he'd give us to do, and the tests he'd give us to do, and the assignments. And I know it was a hard job, and I asked him, "How did you ever get to become this dedicated?" And he said he really didn't know. But he said it started with looking up on the stage and saying, "I want to be up there on that stage." And I think that happens to a lot of us. We go through a process of conversion. But Satan was a great leader, bright and shiny, powerful, beautiful, and all of that. But he got to a point one time where he said, "I want to be the Most High," or "I want to be above others. I want to be like those who the humans that are going to be raised up. I don't like the position I'm in. I want something superior. I deserve something better. And as a result, what did he do? He started war. And what do the leaders around our world do today? What has our human history been? War, fighting, over who's in charge. I remember hearing a story in Ambassador College of a young man who was an assistant. He was going out to be a ministerial assistant, and he was driving in the car, and he changed the radio station. And the minister just jumped his case. What right did he have to do that? You understand, it was all about power. In many cases, not all cases, I don't mean to say that, but I'm just saying there are examples of this. People today will fight over the most trivial things. Anyway, let's go over to Ezekiel 28. We're familiar with, I think, the case of Isaiah 14, where it talks about him wanting to be powerful and so on. But there's this other issue. Ezekiel 28, verse 17. Vanity. Nixon thought it was essential to leadership. Verse 17 of Ezekiel 28, verse 17, where it says this, "Your heart," speaking of Lucifer, "was lifted up because of your beauty, and you've corrupted your wisdom by reason of your brightness. But I'm going to cast you to the ground. I'll lay you before kings that they may behold you." He thought he was so great. He thought he deserved more recognition. Is there anyone of us that doesn't have recognition needs? Is there any one of us that doesn't want an attaboy or attagirl? We want this. We want strokes, don't we? It's part of human nature. The problem is this. Sometimes people will let these things like recognition needs, these kinds of drives, they'll let these kinds of things drive them to excel to the top. And that's their motive. And in every case, whenever they're threatened, they will attack the other person. It's because their motive is about self. And so I want us to ask today, why are we serving at all? Because we're all contributing here, especially in a little group, aren't we? Every one of us are contributing something of great value. But why are we doing it? Well, I think we're doing it to serve God and to serve one another. But I want us to look and see, is the motive now mixed? Is it mixed at all? Are we doing this to serve them? That is God and others, or ourselves. What should be some motives for serving? Gratitude would be one, wouldn't it? Look what he's done for us and how he served us. How about appreciation? Gratitude. To be more and more like Christ. This, I think, should be our goal. This should be our motive. That he was a servant and we're to follow in his footsteps. And can you see this? That when we come and open the hall, when we're putting these chairs out, when we're bringing refreshments, can you see that we can be doing this for him so that we're like him? Because that's what he would be doing, don't you think? You think he'd just be some isolated ivory tower leader? If he came in our congregation, let's say, don't you think Jesus Christ would be here setting up? He'd be right there with us. I really believe that because of him being a servant. So anyway, I say this, practice by serving for the kingdom of God. Proverbs 28, let's go there first, Proverbs 28. A leader must also care about people. A leader must also care about people. It's essential, I really believe that. To me, the problem with leaders today is that they don't really care about other people. And I remember this story that we were told in Ambassador College once where Mr. Armstrong had a chance to have dinner with Hans Joseph Strauss, who was at one time a very powerful leader in Germany. And during dinner, it was the time of Nixon's election. He had just been elected president. And Mr. Armstrong leaned over and he said to Herr Strauss, he said, "What do you think is on the mind of Mr. Nixon right now?" And he laughed. And he turned to Mr. Armstrong and he said, "Well, of course, it's one thing. How do I get reelected?" Because what's the motive of so many leaders today? Staying in power, being important, being on top. But God's leaders have to care about others as much as self, to care about people. And so it says this in Proverbs 28, verse 16, "The prince that wants understanding that is, lacks understanding, is also a great oppressor. And this is so true. Let's go to 2 Chronicles now, chapter 10. And let's look at the example for a minute of Rehoboam. 2 Chronicles 10. You remember this is a case of after Solomon was gone. Solomon had taxed the people out of existence. He had built a beautiful empire. The Queen of Sheba was just so impressed. Why, her heart fainted, it said, that she was so impressed that she had heard how great this kingdom is. When she saw it, she said, man, this just beats anything I'd ever heard. But it costs money, and Solomon had just taxed the people down to the end of all that they had. And so after his death, they came asking the new king, please consider their needs. And here in 2 Chronicles 10, verse 1 through 4, and Rehoboam went to Shechem. To Shechem where all Israel come to make him king. And it came to pass when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was in Egypt, where he had fled from the presence of Solomon the king, heard it, that Jeroboam returned out of Egypt. They sent and called him. So Jeroboam and all Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying this, your father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore ease you somewhat the grievous servitude of your father and his heavy yoke that he put upon us, and then we'll serve you. Well, he counseled with his advisors about this, verse 6 through 11. And King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men that had stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, saying, what counsel do you give me to return answer to these people? And they spoke unto him, saying, if you be kind to this people, and you please them, and you speak good words to them, they'll be your servants forever. But he forsook the counsel which the old men gave him, and he took counsel with the young men that were brought up with him and stood before him. And he said unto them, what advice do you give me that we may return answer to this people which have spoken unto me, saying, ease somewhat the yoke that your father did put upon us? And the young men that were brought up with him spoke unto him, saying, thus shall you answer the people that spoke unto you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it somewhat lighter for us. Thus shall you say unto them, my little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins. For whereas my father put a heavy yoke upon you, I will put more to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I'm going to chastise you with scorpions. He refused to hear their needs. Can you see the insensitivity of this leader towards the people that were going to be under him? And so in verse 12 through 14, so Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam on the third day as the king bade, saying, come again to me on the third day. And the king answered them roughly. And King Rehoboam forsook the counsel of the old men and answered them after the advice of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, but I'm going to add thereto. My father chastised you with whips, but I'm going to chastise you with scorpions. And so he didn't hearken to these people. In verse 16, and when all Israel saw that the king would not hearken to them, the people answered the king, saying, what portion have we in David? And we have none inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to your tents, O Israel, and now David, see to your own house. So all Israel went to their tents, and the kingdom split. So the point I make is this, that he lost so very much here because he was so insensitive to the people that he was ruling over. And I'm not saying that you should let people rule over you, but I am saying that we should be sensitive to their needs, to legitimate needs and desires, and be kind and be gentle to them. Professor James McGregor Burns is a distinguished political scientist and historian, and he wrote a book as well on leaders, and he said this. The main thesis is there's a difference from a power holder and a leader, and he writes this. Power wielders respond to their subjects' needs and motivations only to the extent that they have to in order to fulfill their own power objectives, which remain their primary concern. Does that make sense? Has anybody seen that? Have you seen it in the church? Have you seen it in the political arena? I think you have. He says, true leaders, on the other hand, emerge from and always return to the wants and needs of their followers. Okay, Rehoboam lost so much leadership here because of his insensitivity. And I say this, we've got to care about the people that we lead in our lives. I want you to think about the brethren that sit here in this hall, that we need to be sensitive to each one of our needs here. I think it's only fair. husbands do need to be sensitive to their wives and their needs. And wives need to be sensitive even to their children, those who they're over. Co-workers on a job. I've seen this over and over again. It's all about money and I've got power. You do what I say. Not understanding that they have legitimate needs. I'm kind of impressed in a way with I forget which police force it was, but they just made a ruling now they were going to have flex time for their people. And I think it was a good thing. They said this will make these people able to have a better home life. It'll enable them to spend more time with their families. And I think that kind of sensitivity is meaningful. And when companies do this, why, their employees become very loyal. You can pay 50 cents or a dollar more an hour than the going rate, and the employees will just love you for it. And they'll say, you care about me. And what's 50 cents? It's so minimal to the kind of work. When you need to call on them for extra, to give a little extra, I've seen employees they'll give you so much more than 50 cents or a dollar more an hour. But sometimes employers are just so insensitive to those that are under them, and they lose out as a result of it. But it's our way of life. Fellow students at school, do we care about them? Are we sensitive to them? Do we listen to them and their needs? So I say this, you are a leader, and you're influencing everyone around you, aren't you? To one degree or another, your example is. And so we should, I think, take care to be more sensitive. And I think Paul, as tough a man as he was, let's go to 1 Thessalonians for a moment, because I see Paul personally as a very hard man, a tough man, a man that could take beatings and get up and keep going, a man who was able to face death, a man who was stoned, gets up, and healed from that, walks away. But he wasn't a tough man when it came to the way he administered his authority among the brethren. So 1 Thessalonians 2, if you would, where it talks about Paul, verse 3 through 12. He says this, "For our exhortation was not of deceit or of uncleanness or in guile, but as we were allowed of God to put in trust with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God, which tries our hearts. For neither at any time use we flattering words, as you know, nor a cloak of covetousness. God is our witness. Nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, yet of others. When we might have been burdensome as the apostles of Christ." He wasn't even asking them to support him in some cases. But he says this, "We were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherishes her children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because you were dear to us. For you remember, brethren, that our labor and travail for laboring day and night, because we would not be chargeable to any of you, we preached unto you the gospel of God. You are our witnesses, and God also, how in a holy and just way and unblameably we behaved ourselves among you that believe. As you know, how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father does his children, that you'd walk worthy of God who has called you unto his kingdom and glory." But you see Paul's leadership style? I thought for a long time how many people would, in some cases in my own past experience, we'd have churches where the pastors would leave. And in one case, Paul, he left, and the brethren put their arms around him, around his neck, and they kissed him. And in many cases, I've seen examples where maybe the deacons or the elders would do this because they were close. But I don't think there was the kind of relationship in all cases where the minister was approachable. And I think we have that here in the leadership. And I think you've seen that. And I think it's a good example. And I think Paul reflects this in what he says here. True leaders must understand the people. David Rockefeller said this, "I would pay more for an understanding of how to deal with people than anything else." And so I say this, Christian leaders understand that everybody's different. People are different, aren't they? And so you don't have just one way that you relate to every single person. We're all different. We have different needs, and we have different needs at different times. And it's worth understanding this. Different groups of people and so on. You understand that a young person is different from an elderly person, aren't they? The young person needs encouragement. They need to say, "Attaboy, way to go, you can do it." But an older person needs something altogether different. The elderly need to be honored. God says this in the Bible. He commands it that you honor the elderly. Why? Because when you get to the end of your life, you need validation. Yes, I did good. I raised my family good. I was a good mother. I was a good father. I worked hard. You don't have so much of a future to look forward to, but you look back towards the past. And so you need validation for that. And so it is that women and men are different. You can be very blunt sometimes with a man, but if you try that on women sometimes and just tell them flat out, without perhaps prefacing it with some compliments or something like that, you might find yourself causing trouble. You might cause hurt and so on. And so my point is this, that we're all very, very different. Different personality types. Sometimes people are introverts, and other times people are extroverts. And I know in many cases in the past why everyone thought in the certain churches that the righteous men went to Spokesman's Club. But later I found out that it wasn't. It was the people that had recognition needs mostly that went to Spokesman's Club. And there were often people who served within the congregation. They would serve invisibly because they disdained the visibility. Other people liked the visibility. And so you can serve in those ways. You see what I'm saying? There's different personality types. And one isn't better than the other. They're just simply different. And what happens in some cases in leadership roles, I've seen it where leaders think that those who are going to help them and assist them on their staff, they have to be like them. And they'll go about sometimes trying to make everyone in the company over into their own image because everybody has to be like me. And so I think a Christian leader understands that we're all different and treats people differently and tries to understand the other needs of other people and does this in respect with others and their differences. Anyway, David was a man, second Samuel, after God's own heart. Again, a tremendous example for any one of us, 2 Samuel 5, made mistakes, and that's true. And I think we know most of those. But I say this, David was never a Lucifer. He never was in any case. And so God says this in 2 Samuel 5 and in verse 12, this, I think, fascinating verse. David finally perceived something of great value, and it was this, that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake. Well, what would our tendency be if we saw that God exalted us to some great position? You know what the tendency is? Before my sake, I was good, I did the right thing, and so God has blessed me and given me power and authority and all that. But David had some insight here. He said, wait a minute, God has done this for Israel's sake. David was a different kind of leader. He was a Christian leader. He cared about people, and he understood that God had done this for Israel's sake. Now, God says that he was a man after his own heart. And I want you to think about this. Why? How was he a man after God's own heart? My personal view is this. He would take care of his father's sheep. And when the sheep were attacked by a lion, he would put his life on the line to save the sheep. And that's what I think he's like God that way. Because God did what? He put his life on the line to save his father's sheep. And so David, I think, is like that. And so he cared about Israel. And in other times, he was willing to give up his kingdom. He was willing to give up his kingship so that there wouldn't be a big, huge war that would rip Israel all apart. Other times he said to someone throwing rocks at him, you know, this may be God. I mean, he didn't start out that way, but it may be God punishing me. He was very sensitive to what was going on around him towards the end of his rule. And so I remind us that a Christian must care about other people, a Christian leader. And we also have to be good communicators. And I think this is so important to understand. And I say this on my own. I'm really speaking to myself now when I say this. But think for a moment. Jesus Christ is the Word, isn't he? He's the Word. And when he says something, what happens? It happens. So he calls out, let there be light, and there's light. And that's the kind of power he has. But if we're going to be rulers in that kingdom, we'd better use our tongue carefully because we could say things that are hurting to other people and it could possibly happen. I wish you were dead, you know, or a pox on you or something like that. You understand? It would happen immediately, wouldn't it? And so he wants us then to use those things we have now to control those things, those powers we have, the talents like our tongue, for instance, to help and not to hurt. And so we remember in Malachi 3 and verse 16, where it said this, that God's people would get together and they would speak often to one another. Well, what would they use their tongue for? To encourage, wouldn't they? To comfort and so on. And I remind us too that it says in the scriptures, going to be judged by every idle word. And so a Christian leader is someone that measures his or her words, somebody that is careful with what they say and how they use their tongue. So we shouldn't send mixed messages, and we shouldn't say things that are harmful and hurtful. Remember what James said? Be swift to hear, slow to speak. Listen to what someone's saying. Make sure we understand it before we answer them and that kind of thing. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 1. 2 Corinthians 1. I think it's so important in the Christian community that we work together with that there needs to be correction, of course. But I remind us, too, that we should use the tools that we have to lead others by way of example. And that would be to use our tongue to encourage when we can and comfort others. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 3 and 4, where it says, Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. And I think this is a good example that the Christian leader should not crush others that we're working with and not put them down. Not say cutting things on the job to others. Not say cutting things in school, and not say the cutting things that I know we do when we're at home with one another. Instead, we should be working to encourage others, encourage them on to do a better job. You know, it's a funny thing in this world. I don't know if you would agree with this, but this has been my experience. The time that you really get attention is when you do something wrong. We seldom get attention for just doing the thing that we do right, and we do it daily. I remember there were two boys once when I was a younger man. I had this little apartment, and these two young boys would come over to visit frequently. And the one was a very, very good kid. And he seemed older than his years, I mean, fairly mature, and we'd carry on fairly adult conversations. His little brother was acting out all the time. Well, they spent so much time over at my house, I asked them once, why do you do this? And they said, well, at home it's really unhappy that no one cares about us there and no one pays any attention to us. And I was shopping and picking up my weekly allotment of TV dinners, great cook that I am. And anyway, I took the boys with me to go shopping, and the little kid was just acting out like crazy. And I asked the older one, why is it like that? Why is he so different from you? And he explained to me, this kid was about 12 years old. He had a lot of wisdom, and he said, I try to get attention from you and from other men and others that I know by being good. My little brother has taken another route, and his route works so much better. He gets attention by acting out and doing crazy things all the time. But it's a reflection, I think, of why our society, we aren't there encouraging others. We don't see the person that's trying just quietly to do a good job and go, wow, that's really great. You're really doing good. We don't encourage as much as we will condemn those that are wrong. It just seems to be our tendency. But I want to tell this story. I had taken my kids down to Marineland, and I was just really impressed. I'm sure all of us have probably gone there. You've seen the porpoises do these tricks, and penguins and seals and trained animals and everything. Well, I went down there and went to the killer whale show. You got to understand now, we got whales that are beasts, brute beasts that kill. That's what they're called, killer whales. These great, huge monsters would come up out of the water and carefully take a fish out of the mouth of a little lady who that whale could swallow in a second. And then she would get on the whale and ride it. And all around this huge pool riding the whale, and the whale would go left or right or do whatever she said, and then she'd throw a ball up. The whale, you wouldn't even see it. Throw this ball up. The whale would come up and catch the ball from the depths of this pool. I was just stunned. Man, after the show's over, I ran as fast as I could to get the trainer. And I asked the trainer, I went down and asked her, I said, how in the world can you get a brute beast like this, a monstrous killer whale, to do such intricate tricks? And she said this. She said, well, it's easy. All you do is reward anything that comes close. You want the whale to make a left turn. If it just moves its nose slightly, you reward it. If it moves a little bit more, you reward it some more. Goes to the right, you don't reward it. Eventually, the whale will keep moving to the right, to the left, the way you want it. And just bit by bit, by rewarding anything that comes close, you can get a brute beast to do anything you want it to do. And I'm going, man, why don't the wives in the Church of God understand this? You can get your brute beast to do anything you want him to do if you'll reward what comes close. But instead, what we do is what? Criticize anything that isn't right on spot. Don't we? Sometimes we do. So I want us to think about this in terms of Christian leadership and this issue of encouragement. That I think it's really important that we think in terms of, okay, you're an employer. We can get more out of our employees by rewarding them when they're doing things right or getting close to right. When we're a husband, we can get so much more out of our family. When we're a wife, we can get so much more out of our husbands. This is a principle I'd like us to understand, to reward what comes close rather than attacking for when we make mistakes. It's a point I think will work so well to get us what we all desire in life so much. So if someone's hurting in the congregation, know about it. Sometimes people are going through heavy trials, trials at work, loss of jobs, and we should be aware of that. Praying about it in private, but comforting people in public, comforting them one-on-one. And so it says this, Proverbs 12 and verse 25, heaviness in the heart of man makes it stoop, but a good word makes it glad. Let's use our mouths to encourage and comfort one another. Make our brethren glad and develop skills in being a good Christian leader. Can you see it as us as God in the kingdom of God with God's children of the millennium and the second resurrection? Can you see us throwing lightning bolts around every time they miss a note? Or would we rather be there encouraging them? I think both is necessary, but I think the most necessary is encouragement and comfort for other people. So I ask us here, spend time in fellowship with one another, speak often to one another, and do so with an idea towards encouraging and comforting the people here. Use communication skills to serve the people of God. Another point is this, accept responsibility for what we do. And it's so typical in human nature, isn't it, that Adam and Eve sin and God asks about it and he says, the woman, it's her fault, basically. He says, you know, she gave to me and I did eat. But he sort of blamed his wife in a sense. But if we're going to be leaders, if we're going to be in the first resurrection, I think we've got to see this thing about taking responsibility for whatever it is. Others who are followers blame other people, I think, and no matter how they may build themselves as leaders. So anyway, 1 Corinthians 12, let's go over there. We're fairly close. 1 Corinthians 12. Take responsibility. 1 Corinthians 12, verse 14. For the body is not one member, in verse 14, but many. If the foot shall say, because I'm not of the hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? Ridiculous. If the ear shall say, because I'm not of the eye, I'm not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole body were the hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, every one of them in the body, as it's pleased him. And so we're all placed in the body where it's pleased Jesus Christ. We should take responsibility for where we're placed, where we find ourselves. Remember it said that Christ finding himself in the form of a man, you didn't maybe choose to be where you are or be what you are, but finding yourself in this position, finding yourself in this place, humble ourselves and serve to the best of our ability, becoming like Christ, even sacrificing some of our own things, some of our own wants, some of our own feelings, some of our own desires, so that we can then be able to serve and help others. Now, what about mistakes? Everyone makes mistakes in life. But one of the things I've seen is, boy, I'll tell you, most world leaders, they will never admit a single mistake that they make. Sometimes I think that they think if they admit a mistake, then you'll think less of them and they'll have less authority and less command and be able to rule even less. But I think Jimmy Carter was a good example in this case, because when he planned and commanded that raid on Iran and it failed, he just came out to everybody and said it failed. What I wish he would have done was gone in with really heavy force and corrected the mistake. But I do give him this credit, that he did admit that it was his mistake and that he had taken the responsibility for it. I'd love to be able to be in the kingdom of God. I'd love to be able to practice and prepare as I should and do some of these things that I think are valuable. They're not all the aspects of leadership. There are others, and I'm very convinced that there are aspects that are more commanding, more general-like, and so on. But for us here, I don't think we're at war with one another. 2 Samuel 23, verse 2 and 3 says this, "The Spirit of the Lord spoke unto me, and his word was in my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke unto me. He that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." And I think if we're going to do that, we must not be self-willed. We must not think that we're more than we are. We must not be presumptuous, but must instead be able to realize if we hurt someone, we made a mistake, simply admit it. But then I say this, pick ourselves up and go on. I remember once I was called into thermal air. I'd made a mistake. And they called me in, and I was kind of shocked and so on, because I thought of myself as really a qualified man, one of their best technicians, and so on. But they called me in, and they brought this to my attention. I was shocked. I mean, I had the breath knocked out of me, in a sense, when they told me what I had done and how it had affected them, and they were very upset. And I remember the general manager came over to me and he put his arm around me and he said, "Well, Art, it's not the mistake. It's not when we find ourselves knocked down in life that matters nearly as much as how we get up, acknowledge our mistake, and then what we do after that. Will we take responsibility for it, learn from it, and then pick up and go on strong?" I think that was some of the best advice I ever got in life. Mistakes are going to happen. Just admit them. And then let's see how you come off of that floor. You've been knocked down. Now let's see you get up. So in the case of numbering Israel in 1 Chronicles 21, you remember the case of David. He had numbered Israel. And they were now suffering terribly as a result. In verse 17 of chapter 21, David said unto God, "Is it not I that commanded the people to be numbered, even I that have sinned and done evil indeed? But as for these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand, I pray you, O Lord my God, be on me and on my father's house, but not on your people, that they should be plagued." What a beautiful example of leadership, isn't it? I did this. Don't punish them. Let me take responsibility. Didn't justify himself. He didn't look for someone else to blame. He just took the responsibility. And so I think these are good examples for us who are called to be leaders, to take responsibility for our job, for what we do, take it as a sacred trust, and do the best we can. And if we make mistakes, to admit them, pick up and go forward. And I think it's a motivational verse in the Bible that says, "Whatsoever you do, do with all your might," applies in this case. So it's an important key for us, I think, as leaders. Another one is this, to be visibly growing yourself. Let's go to John 13, verse 15. Key number five is this, to be visibly growing yourself. That a good leader is always going to be a leader who leads by example, and so it's got to be one who is growing spiritually. Jesus Christ the example. He lived his life for us. He came down here to earth for what reason? To die for us. But there's another reason, isn't there? He came down to earth to be the example, to live an example of how God would live if he were a man. And he stated this in John 13 and verse 15. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done unto you. And this was, of course, the example of the foot washing. But it's an example that exists for us and was given to us, not to reflect what we're to do on Passover, but to what we're to do every bit of our lives all the time. To have this in our minds, that we are to be an example to others. And so if you're working in a company, you need to be living and growing in your skills. That you've got to be able to lead others by having talents and abilities. And so when I was at Thermalair, of course, I had to continue to study and I'd get manufacturers' information. But as a Christian, we have to continue to study in his word. Continue to be growing ourselves personally, growing in our job skills, growing in our Christian conversion, and in our relationship skills with others. And the reason is this, there's a ripple effect. People will see you growing, and they'll see that example, and they'll learn from it, and they'll then begin to pick that up. I've seen this so many times with people when I've been around individuals, and I'll just tell you that I admired. You know what happens? I begin to adopt their little quirks. Sometimes I'll start to speak like them. I remember I picked up so much stuff from Denny because I admired him so much. And I'd start talking like him. And I still can find myself. I remember somebody came up and says, "You sound sometimes like Mr. Catherwood when you speak." Well, I admired how he ran the congregation so much that I kind of automatically, without trying to do it, I began to sort of just identify it. I began to copy that. I see people in marriages that they start to copy one another. And sometimes after many years, people will say, "You two look alike." You know, you just begin to adopt the attributes of the other one. Because of your close relationship. And so it is that we should have that kind of close relationship with Christ. But we also have to realize that others will pick up our example and they'll automatically begin to live by it. And so we sort of have a leadership role, just leading by example. So anyway, Paul gives Timothy advice. Don't let anybody despise your youth, he says, but be an example to the believers, he commanded his young protege, you might say. That this is what we're to be with one another. Be visibly growing, brethren. Be visibly growing because you owe it to each one in the congregation yourself. Then I want to say this. The sixth key is this. Have a balanced approach towards the goal. Hitler had a great goal. Fantastic goal. He envisioned a time when he would have the German peoples be the greatest nation on earth. That's not a bad goal, is it? What happened? What happened to him? He wasn't balanced in the goal. The goal became so important, nothing else mattered. And I've seen this in leaders around my experience, all through my own personal history. I've seen it outside the church and inside the church. Someone wants what they want so bad, they will drive their employees. They'll overwork them. They'll extract everything they can get out of them. They'll drive church members so that they have the greatest plain truth distribution numbers in their area. You understand what I'm getting at? Because the goal is so important that nothing else matters. But what matters most? Why is the universe here? People. People are what matter the most, aren't they? That's what's the most valuable product here. That's what it's all about. It's about people. And so we can't have a desire to accomplish the goal that is so strong and so powerful that we just ride over people, that we don't care about their needs, their feelings, and so on. It's got to be balance. On the other hand, there's people that care so little about the goal that they'll plod along just worrying about each little step and along the way. They'll be so picky about things that we never get to the goal, you understand? And then hope deferred makes the heart sick. We never seem to see the goal getting closer. And so if you're in a position where you are running a department, or if you're in a position where you're administering the church, I think this is valuable to have. That is, small, short-term goals that are connected very intimately with the long-term goals so that we can see some progress being made. We try to do this here. We haven't grown a lot, for sure, But on the other hand, we have got programs in place moving in that direction. We see that we've picked up in our responses. We are getting more, I think, good notes, and people are sending money to us. That kind of thing is happening, and there are small goals that will, in time, lead to the long-term goal. But what we've got to do is put it in perspective and not make the goal more important than people and not make the people more important than the goal. I've seen that in another larger church where the people in the ministry became more important than preaching the gospel, and I think it's a mistake. Philippians 3 and verse 13. So are you a husband? And do you have a goal for the family? And are you rushing it so that everybody's just in tears? Is this happening? Because it can happen. No pointing now. I only say this by experience. But you understand my point is that this is what we can do. We can have a goal for the family, and we can drive everybody nuts because we're in such a rush to accomplish our goal, and so on. And Paul was very goal-oriented. Brethren, in verse 13 of chapter 3, I count myself not to have apprehended. He didn't have the goal attained yet, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things that are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press towards the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. And then he says this, let us therefore, as many as be perfect, be thus minded, and if anything you be otherwise minded, God shall reveal even this unto you. We press forward towards the mark. And Jesus Christ said, seek the kingdom of God first and his righteousness. So you see those things tied together, that we seek the kingdom of God, but we do so by exercising his righteousness. And would he just overrun people? No. He wouldn't even let them go hungry for a day. You understand people could listen to him and not eat for a day. He was so considerate and kind that he fed those people when he was speaking to. So we need to be goal-oriented, but we need to have a balanced approach to that goal. The goal of the local church is to be a support group, I believe, for people. The goal of a deacon is to set up chairs and get things prepared. What for? For people. What's the goal of me preparing a sermon? It's for your edification, for your growth. It's all about people. It isn't about church growth, and it isn't about becoming big, and it isn't about being powerful. It isn't any of those things. And so we've got to keep everything in perspective, preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God and nurturing the people of God, feeding them and nourishing them towards the kingdom of God. So important to do this. We can get so fixated on the goal. I was in a congregation once in a galaxy far away a long time ago, and we had a lot of potlucks, and there were certain crew that worked in the kitchen and ladies there, and they were headed up by a deaconess. But over time, she became very territorial. The goal became her being in charge of that kitchen. And there was another lady that came in, and she was trying to get something done in that kitchen and wasn't invited. This deaconess pulled a knife on her and held it up to her. I don't think she was going to use it, but she was so territorial about this is my kitchen and it exists for this one purpose here and I'm in charge that she would actually even think to hold a knife up to one of the brethren. But this is how it can get. There was another case out in a congregation I attended in where two men went into they had a fist fight. You know what it was over? What areas each one was to usher, you see, that one guy thought he had this area and this guy thought he had this area and there was some crossover here and it was over who had the authority to usher over that area. Now let me ask you a question. What's the purpose of ushering? It's to help serve these people and make sure they're comfortable and make sure they find a seat and make sure all the woman's stuff and baby stuff is all taken care of, and that's their purpose. Well, let me ask you a question. Whose ever territory it was, what difference would that make in accomplishing the goal? Silly, isn't it? But aren't we sometimes silly, the things we fight over, and not serving one another as we should have? So the goal is not of the church, is not to fulfill our own personal ego needs, but it is to serve one another. Richard Nixon said this in his book, duplicity, secrecy, ruthlessness, all are permissible if they serve a greater cause. whatever the field, the critical moral questions are, in effect, those of the bottom line. What's the bottom line? To get reelected. And so it was okay, wasn't it, to go into Watergate, to break in, break laws, to get information on your opponents so that you could be reelected. But it can't be that way with any of us. It can't be that way. We've got to make sure that our goal and what we do to attain the goal line up. And that is to be righteous like Christ is righteous. And I want to give a sermon on that just alone. Who he is, what he is, what he's like, and why we've got to be like him. Anyway, key number 7, we'll finish up with this. Be a working leader in your life, whether it's at your job or in your home or in the church of God. Sometimes managers will delegate everything away. Have you ever seen this? They put themselves in a managerial ivory tower. They're very distant from their people. They're distant from the work being done. They have no grasp of what's going on there. And I remember when I was in the Navy, I was an enlisted man, and the whole issue here was we had to work very hard in the Navy. You'd work on the decks, you'd paint, you'd do all of these things for late, like 8 or 10 hours a day. Then you had to stand a 4-hour watch, which could be in the middle of the night. And after a few weeks of this, you're just so run down and so tired and everything. So what the goal was on our particular ship was you could become an E4, as a third-class petty officer. And if you were a third-class petty officer, you didn't have to do that. You made the work assignments. And these guys, what they did was they walked around with a coffee cup. That's what they did all day long. And they would be there walking around with a coffee cup, and they were just immaculately clean. You understand, we had paint drips all over, sweaty and dirty. These guys were immaculately clean, and they just had beautiful creases in their pants and in their shirts and so on. And that was the whole point of it, was to become an E4 so that you didn't have to work. Now, this created something. One, it created absolute hatred for the E4. Okay? The other thing it was is that it created all this fawning. People would fawn the guy who had made E4 so that he could be his friend and get the easier assignments. But it's all wrong. That a leader should be a working leader, working with the men, showing them how to do the job better, and in there doing it with them. Anyway, Nehemiah is a good example. I won't go there for lack of time right now, but I want to remind you of this great servant of God who did not have the approach of ivory tower leadership. He was in there working. This man strapped on a sword and worked when they were being attacked, and he worked with the other men, and he gave them a beautiful, I think, example of what a leader is supposed to be like. Put himself, his life on the line for the work he was doing and would not stop no matter what. You remember Uriah? Man, I think his example is a good one. He told David, I can't do this. I can't be here just having it easy and in living in luxury when my men are out in the field. I have to be out fighting with my men. Man, it was a beautiful example. George Washington was a working leader. Here's an example. The Continental Army had camped once during a long, cold, and bleak winter. General Washington had wrapped up all to keep warm, left his headquarters, and he walked down the road to a point where soldiers were fortifying the camp. They didn't recognize him, and a small group of soldiers were trying with all their might to hoist a large, heavy log into position. A corporal commanded them with a superior tone, belittling the straining men as they worked. The general observed the men there, and twice they attempted to hoist the log, and twice it fell back. The corporal cried out with a third attempt, "Heave hard! Push!" he ordered. Again they struggled under the ponderous weight, but again the log began to fall backwards. And when Washington saw them straining for the third time without the possibility of success, he ran over to the group and pushed against the log with all his strength, and the log rolled into place. The men, exhausted and panting, eagerly sought to thank him. But he turned towards the corporal and said, "Why don't you help your men with this heavy lifting when they needed another hand?" he asked. "Why didn't I?" the man replied. "Don't you see that I'm the corporal?" "Indeed," Washington cried, throwing on his great coat and exposing his uniform. "I'm only the commander-in-chief. Next time you have a log too heavy for these 4 young men to lift, send for me." That's a powerful example, isn't it? And that's how I see Jesus Christ. I see him feeding people, serving them. healing them. I see him as a working leader. And if you're going to be a Christian leader, I think you need to have that approach instead of the ivory tower managerial approach. One time, President Dwight D. Eisenhower said this: "I have long suspected that men and women who possess the capacity for leadership are always among us, waiting in the wings, but it sometimes takes a great crisis to bring them to prominence. Perhaps the greatest of these qualities, that is, those for leadership, is single-minded and selfless dedication to the task at hand. If he's a really, truly great leader, the cause must predominate over the self." Man, I think that's a good quote for us in our time, don't you? That you could have all sat in some large church listening to sermons. But the crisis that has come upon us has caused all of you to be raised into positions where now you are contributing on significant and meaningful levels. And I really believe what he's saying, that our task must predominate over self. This is the Christian leadership that God asks of us. And I remind you of this. It may be small. It may just be that refreshment table. It may just be setting up these chairs. It may be giving a sermon. It may be just helping write a booklet, whatever it is. But I want us to remember this one great truth. God has said, if you are faithful in that which is least, that is just putting the chairs up, just giving a drink of water to someone else for Christ's sake, then he knows we'll be faithful in that which is much. But right now we're dealing with those things that are least. Soon we're going to deal with those things that are much. And he will if we're faithful in this. And if we are the kind of leaders that have a heart like David, if we're the kind of leaders that have the heart as so many of the other of great servants of God, what will he do for us? I tell you, the last shall be first. And that we have the chance here to live like Christ in our lives now and serve like he does and grow to be leaders that will have magnificent, powerful, wonderful positions where we can use the examples we've learned here in helping so many millions in the kingdom to come.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.